Thanks for downloading the Flaneur Christmas podcast. This week we look at A Christmas Carol at the Pleasance, French DVD Mood Indigo, the novelistic biography Limonov, and Variety Soup, a very amusing vaudeville act at the Leicester Square Theatre. The auditorium for the matinee of A Christmas Carol at the Pleasance was full of babbling schoolchildren and a teacher who could silence them all with one bark. "I want bags on the floor, not on your knees," she ordered the entire theatre. If I'd had a bag on my knees, I would have strongly considered moving it. Dickens wrote his ghostly parable back in 1843, but its tale of redemption remains relevant, as does its belief in the possibility of change, even for bankers. A Christmas Carol has been adapted for the stage many times. Dickens himself re-edited the work and performed dramatic public readings of Scrooge's experiences. The present adaptation is by Danny Wainwright, performed by Let Them Call It Mischief. With added humour, the plot follows the well-known story. That is, Scrooge, the meanie, is visited by three ghosts. They show him the results of his attitudes and behaviour. He has the chance to change and be transformed. Does he take it? Maximising the comedic possibilities of the play, the seven actors romp about the stage, playing over 40 different characters in the 90 minutes. Elliot Ross in particular, bringing an enjoyable cheer to the busy proceedings. Together they unleash song and dance routines that Dickens almost certainly didn't perform in his public readings, including a medley of dance styles, reminiscent of the YouTube hit Evolution of Dance. Maxwell Taylor is the beaming, bow-tied narrator who holds the show together, after starting proceedings reading from the wrong Dickens novel. He humorously interferes with the action, the actor struggling to keep up with his description of what is happening on stage. He argues with the characters, forgets to give some details. At one point, he's still backstage when needed. Tiny Tim's role is taken by an unusual actor. He probably doesn't have much to say at after-show parties and is almost certainly the worst paid of the troupe. He's got something of the frog about him. If you don't know the story, it must be confusing to see a puppet on stage. It adds to the fun, but reduces the sense of dire poverty that Scrooge's actions are helping to create. What engaged the children most? They enjoyed Alyssa Noble's accidental water spillage and the subsequent, more careful fetching of another drink. They also loved answering rhetorical questions. "What day is it?" asked Benedict Waring's genial Scrooge. Up shoot several hands. But most of all they enjoyed Robert Rowe, both dressed as a sparkly rectangular Christmas present when playing the ghost of A Christmas Present, and wearing a white tutu and dancing with a wand. The British amusement at a man in a dress obviously starts young. The excitement and subsequent chatting and shushing peaked every time Marley's ghost appeared in a blaze of lights and dry ice. This isn't a dry Victorian tale focusing on the poverty of some and the nastiness of others, but a celebration of redemption told with humour. Accessible to children, though they might need the story recapping afterwards, which is an issue as much with the supernatural plot as the production. You can imagine the questions the teachers were fielding on the walk home. So those people were ghosts. Why was he dressed as a Christmas present? And probably most confusing of all for a small child, why was that man holding a talking frog? Find out at the Pleasance until the 4th of January. Careful if you take any sweets, or the teacher might confiscate them. Variety Soup opens with an amusing Buster Keaton-inspired film sequence. It shows Gorenwy Tom's journey from towel-losing swimmer at Brighton to a formally dressed master of ceremonies at the Leicester Square Theatre. It's such an amusing beginning. I fear that productions that start with the performers merely walking on stage will from now on feel staid and unimaginative. The rest of the show continues the high laugh quotient, with the seven members of Slightly Fat all contributing to the onstage buffoonery. Richard Geraghty and John Hicks in particular are able to induce laughter with just an expression, but each of the gang is an experienced performer. Herbie Treehead laments throughout that he is 46, and the others are of a similar age. Given the troupe's name and the amount of male flesh that is on display over the course of the evening, it seems fair to comment on their chosen name. Slightly Fat is a misnomer. At least two of the performers are flattered by the description. At least two suffer an unwarranted calumny. Gareth Jones gives a masterclass in trust, as he allows himself to be wrapped in cling film in order to become a human butterfly pupa, eventually to be hanging by his feet from the ceiling. If ever a kids don't try this at home warning was necessary, it would be during the matinee performances of this sketch. At the 8:40 p.m. show, the audience's laughs turned to silence as the cling film was wrapped more and more tightly around Jones's head. Never play with plastic bags has been drummed into us ever since we first played with a plastic bag. And after a while, I was looking around for St. John's ambulance and feeling uncomfortable that something was about to go horribly wrong. When I was almost certain I was about to witness an onstage death, a colleague broke an air hole through the film and the human butterfly could breathe again. He sounded very relieved. First seen at Edinburgh and other fringe festivals, the production does feel as though it has been lengthened from the usual fringe running length. Some of the sketches are overlong, others could be cut. Performance art is an apt description for the creation of John Hicks' Bazalit-style portrait, but though it is clever, it needs speeding up as it loses some momentum and has the audience shifting in their seats. A scene with an elephant balancer and mousetrap-style catapult also felt too long. I would mix up the order, move the optimistic happy song to the end of the show, and have everyone leave on a rousing, participatory high. There will be many sketches from the show described at length to friends over Christmas dinner, from the tiny rooting-tooting cowboy to the levitating elephant, tiger training, and delightfully obvious cutting a man in half. Circus skills combined with singing dogs, songs, cross-auditorium Diablo tricks, and much more. One long sketch relies on an audience member dragged onto stage, which can sometimes be disagreeable, but last night Darren got a well-deserved round of applause, and his name was chanted in admiration. Particularly amusing is Find the Lady, an absurd enlarged version of the ancient cups and balls trick. It utilises orange buckets, wigs, and distinctly unfeminine human heads. Revelling in mistakes, lo-fi production values, and physical comedy, Variety Soup is hard to beat for good-natured, family-friendly laughs. If you do leave the theatre humming one of Herbie Treehead's tunes, you can buy the album online. I hope mine arrives before Christmas. Liminov is a biography that reads like a novel. Emmanuel Carrère's first-person biographical bestseller has been translated from the French by John Lambert and tells the remarkable adventures of Russian dissident Eduard Liminov. It is not an easily summarised tale. The book tells how Liminov has at times been, amongst other things, a valet in New York and a writer in Paris. He was a soldier in the Balkans, where he interviewed Karadzic. He's also a poet and leader of the banned Russian political party, National Bolshevik. "Why do you want to write a book about me?" Liminov asked the author. Carrère, who at one point refers to Liminov as his hero, answered that he had led a fascinating life, a romantic, dangerous life, a life that dared to engage directly with history. Liminov's comment on this appraisal? Yeah, a shitty life. Carrère might well be giving Liminov too much credit and admiration, but it's this life that he spends 340 pages retelling. Originally planning to become a butcher, Liminov grew up in the Soviet Union, where bad eyesight kept him out of the army. A fight in school is portrayed as the moment when he decided he wanted to become the sort of person that other people don't attack because they are worried you might kill them. Liminov steals, fights, seduces men and women. He wants revolution, to hijack planes, or bomb something. He is frightened not by death, but by the idea of dying unknown. He wants people to read of his death and think, that guy must have really lived. So he devotes his life to really living. And we hear about his successes and failures in New York, Russia, Paris and the Balkans. Carrère brings himself into the story with varying degrees of relevancy. There's his Peace Corps trip to get out of military service, a trip to Cannes to interview Werner Herzog, time spent in Romania. We hear of his university professor mother providing the link between him and Liminov, having been sent a copy of his book, The Russian Poet Prefers Big Blacks, which is Carrère's introduction to his subject. In passing, Carrère also mentions another family member. His cousin Paul Klebnikov was an investigative journalist writing about economic crime in Russia. He was murdered in Moscow in 2004. This is only given a paragraph, but should have been a much larger focus of Carrère's Russian investigations. Subjects that are given more room are eclectic, including the history of French polemical newspaper L'Idiot, Moldova, and anecdotes about protection rackets in Russian clubs. There is also backroom detail about real-world events, like the 91 coup in Russia and the Serbian War. Anecdotes describe Russian life, including the growth of Soviet bureaucracy and the need for two men to do every job. That's one to do it, and one to make sure he does it. But then you need one to make sure he does his job, and another to make sure he does his job. Add, if not infinitum, then something close. They also tell of the demoralizing work of Gulag prisoners, who have to empty prison yard puddles with a glass. Virtuous qualities do not obviously shine through in Limonov's life, and the book contains lengthy descriptions of various kinds of undistinguished behaviour. The first-person style gives an immediacy to the story, but also an informal lack of authority. Interesting for the glimpses of modern Russian, Croatian and other history, but it's a book that will only really appeal to the ardent Russophile. British cartoonist W. Heath Robinson was an inventor of the oddest contraptions. He would have loved Mood Indigo, which is full of the sort of mad machinery that he enjoyed creating. In particular, he would have liked the Pianoctale, a modified piano that produces different drinks according to the tunes played on its keyboard. Although if the music played is too hot, you end up with an omelette. The entire film, based on Froth and the Daydream by Boris Vian, makes about as much sense as Pianoctale. It creates a world where lung diseases are treated with bouquets of flowers and books can be read by ingesting pills. A human-faced mouse shares Colin's house and interacts with visitors. Someone appears to live in the fridge. If you hadn't guessed, it's a Michel Gondry film. At its centre, Mood Indigo is a love story between Colin and Chloe, played by the French big guns Romain Duris and Audrey Tautou. Chloe falls ill and Colin tries to find a cure. But this tragic tale is dressed up in surreal wackiness. Colin's shoes have a life of their own, setting off before he is ready. The doorbell keeps turning into an insect and leaving its duties behind. Eels appear from the taps. Tables are cleared by pushing everything onto the floor. If there's a plate of food, it's almost certainly animated. If you can't take all this magic, then the director's cut is a long 2 hours 14 minutes. Paris is as beautiful as ever, but the constant whimsical trickery becomes wearing. In the best part of the script, Colin's best friend Chick, Gad Elmaleh, has an amusing obsession with the French philosopher Jean-Saul Sartre, who speaks various forms of nonsense, sometimes from the bowl of a large pipe. Chick wastes a fortune on books and also a full-size mannequin of his hero. Later, the colour drains out of the film. Unfortunately, this effect reflects what happens to the viewer's interest. By the end, I had little idea what was going on, and not much interest either. Duris and Tautou are an attractive couple, but Mood Indigo hides their relationship behind tiresome special effects, whilst the plot confuses without being interesting. Thanks for listening. Have a great Christmas and a happy 2015.